Welcome to ITE 1, Module 5, Part 3. And this chapter is huge, and that's why we've done it in three parts. It's literally about two chapters worth of material. And about two chapters worth of labs, too. You guys have a ton of labs for Chapter 5. I would be getting on those sooner rather than later, or else you will be far behind, because you also have a ton of labs for Chapter 6. Any questions on any labs at this point?
I want to make a point, which I often do, but this particular point. We've had a few people who will not be named that were terrified that they didn't know stuff. And I've had this every year I've done this course. Guys, you don't have to know stuff. You have to be able to find stuff. You have to be able to be getting good at finding stuff. Whether you know stuff is not particularly relevant until you actually get out in the field and you start getting some field experience. So the key of this course is to actually get research skills and the ability to rat stuff up off the net, and that is the key. And I'm not just pointing at this year's people. We've had this problem all the way through. We don't expect you to know all this stuff before you get started, because you wouldn't be doing the course if you did.
Yeah, if you don't know stuff, it's good. It means you're getting your money's worth.
Exactly, and
even
you don't
Einstein
have to know.
Einstein didn't know stuff. He said he didn't know his phone number. He just knew where to look it up.
You don't have to pull out, be able to absolutely in your head match all of these components to boards just off the bat. I can't do it. I have to look things up. I have to look at your labs. When I'm looking at your labs, you don't see me actually grade them.
I do.
All you get is a right or wrong answer, and half the time, and Drew's seen me do this as well because he called me and I was sitting there creating labs. He didn't know whose they were, but I kept asking, is such and such possible? And I was talking to Carrie and Drew, and I'm just like, is this possible?
I basically go, I don't know either. Ask him, because he knows everything.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, sometimes he didn't know, so I'll go Google up and prove if something is or isn't possible all the time. I mean, I know some of this in my head, and I can do a lot of it, but there are just some things you don't know, and that's all right. And it's looking it up. Now, there are things that you do want to memorize, and you do want to drill into your head. Those I'll talk about, and I'll say, hey, these are testable. These may be on the A+. These may be on your exam. These are the things you want to know by rote, because when you sit down and take your A+ exam, there is no internet, but there also isn't going to be you having to match up in your head an entire motherboard for an antiquated system either.
Especially not anymore. A+ has got updated just a few months ago.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And apparently Windows 7 content is coming as well. I just read something
yesterday. Yeah, I just saw that.
Yeah. If you need
I think
help
the other
with
thing...
research stuff, I've written something up on Google, and if people would like it, I could give it to them. I don't know if Carrie and Grace have reviewed it yet, but the person at my job liked it. So, if you need something, just a very
well, we
basic
can put it up.
I
might end up writing a lot of those up myself, actually, for the same reason.
You probably will.
Similar.
Well, actually, we'll put it up, Sean. I'll review it a bit later today, and we'll make a general instructions folder under ITE1, and that will have random bits in it, unless you want it to go into the global general instructions folder. And we'll put it up there. Yeah, all right, I'll stick it there then. Yeah. So,
is
anybody
in course? Any of
Has anyone looked in general instructions on the QCAT website? You go student resources and you go... Actually, Does anybody want me to move the student resources link closer to the top? I'm going to push...
Yeah, that would be absolutely excellent.
Or make Let's a landmark it. For it so yeah, you could jump to the landmark.
I just insert F7 all the time. Yeah. I don't even know.
I just hit the V key for last visit or visited link and just jumped out.
Here's a thought.
Is there a list links command for NVDA?
/student.php. Insert F7.
Oh, that works.
Actually, you know what else I'm going to think of doing? Is making a virtual domain called students.qcat.org and then pointing that directly into student resources.
Oh
my god,
that'd be great. Oh, yeah. Hey, can we have an ITE1.qcat.org?
Oh, come on.
That's just too easy. No, students.qcat.org/ITE1 should be easy enough.
Can we just have the answers to all the tests on the front page?
Sure. I'll put
I'm
those
sorry,
up tonight.
I just think that would be totally awesome. Yeah.
Works
for me. Because Drew has all the answers.
Students.qcat is a great idea.
We'll look at that, and I might
do. But... Well,
no, it's not hard. Although we may have to come up with some sort of index.html page so it looks a bit prettier than an index, because I don't like to have indexes sitting out on the web. So,
well, that's what you've got at this moment for everything past Ite1 awesome. Or the class name.
Yeah, but well, I can actually put index.html in the tops of those folders, and it will actually override the indexing code. So we'll look and see what we can come up with.
I'm just saying, if you go into ITE1 or Discover or whatever, then it's shows up as indexes.
Yeah, that's right. We did that for a reason. Listing. Yeah. The other thing we're going to do.
That wouldn't really matter though, Kerry, because like if anyone's showing anyone else qcat.org or whatever, they're going to go through qcat.org rather than students.qcat.org, do you know what I mean?
We'd like them to.
Well, yeah, you'll still be able to get to it probably through the main qcat.org page. We're just wanting to set up a simple...
Yeah, but that's,
you can just remember, if you're students, so type students.qcat.org.
It doesn't matter if it's just whatever you call
we'll
them.
We'll have both.
Yeah, we're going to have both.
Yeah, we're both.
But the point is, if you are showing somebody qcat.org, go through www. Because that way they get to see the donate link and they get to see all of the logos and stuff. But if you're just doing your work at home, we'll go to this students.qcat.org or whatever. I think that's a really good idea, and I think I will actually look at doing ITE1 dot and discovery dot. And
yeah, that'd be really kind of cool.
That's what I was going to ask. Would
the other thing
like
I'm going to do...
students.qcat.org/ite1 or / discovery, or would it be like students.qcat.org/discovery.htm or whatever?
That it possibly
yeah,
that'd
be easier for you
because if I'm looking for discovery stuff or whatever, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm going to have to
look
at it.
I think it makes sense to do it the first way.
I was just going to have ITE1 dot and students dot because it'd save me mucking around with the rewriting module. Anyway, this has got nothing to do with
we
the
talk about that
lecture.
Tomorrow.
So yeah. Let's get back into lecture. But one of the things I would like to point out as a long-term goal is to turn our lectures into podcasts. So if anybody's got any resources on how to do that, you could talk to me, and these lectures will become podcasts, and you can dump them on your iThing or your Juice Extractor or whatever you want to use.
You just need RSS feeds.
Interesting idea.
I think so. I'm not sure. I've got to do some research, but...
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
And the reason why we would do that is because it will just automatically be dumped to your iThing if you follow that podcast feed. No action necessary you.
Or your Symbian phone, just so that the non-i people don't feel left out.
If your computer, anything with a podcatcher, you'll just have your lectures.
Fair enough. That could be cool.
Anyone ever figured a trick to getting curriculum on the iThing? I'd love to do that because I travel a lot and it would be cool.
You can't because the problem is there's no flash. Or if there is flash, it's not accessible. So what you can get is the text dumps.
The ITE1 stuff you can. The ITE1 stuff is HTML. You can do that.
Yeah, that's true. The ITE1 stuff is raw HTML. But if you want the text dumps of the other... Can you what?
Can you actually save it on the iThing, though? I mean, you can view the website.
Dropbox will let you do that.
Save it.
Yeah, Dropbox or Filer.
Which one is the favorite button, but yeah, you can... Or Filer.
Yeah,
you can
I
just save
added
as
this
too,
as a favorite. I don't know how to delete it now.
Well, let's look at that in lecture. But yeah, Filer worked really well for me, and it got files onto my thing. And yes, you can dump the curriculum chapters onto the iThing. Also, don't forget, people, that... we don't have a lot of content in this format yet, but Daisy Worm reads Daisy books on the iThing, and text support is being worked on, just so you guys know.
Yeah.
Well, I'll get it if I don't need another iThing.
Oh, you poor thing.
Doesn't do Bard, right?
It's where they're working on it. Now, the other thing that I was going to mention is, very quickly, there is, and this is handles to both PCs and iThings, there is a URL called preyproject.com. It's some open source that when your iThing goes missing... you can actually get it to tell you where it is and stuff. As soon as it comes online and somebody powers it up, it will actually tell you where it is. All right, let's get on with lecture.
Is that just for the phone? Or?
No, for Macs, PCs, and iThings.
Okay. Hold on. So, is somebody... Okay, one of our volunteers just showed up. All right, so labs, guys... if you have not submitted any labs for a while, now might be the time to do it. I'm almost caught up on grading everybody's labs. And, if you don't start submitting more labs soon, if you've kind of lapsed, you're going to get
really
behind and you're going to get stressed out, and we don't want that for you. We want you to enjoy the class, and you won't enjoy it if you look at the Chapter 3 and 5 labs and just start to cry.
And eventually, I'm probably going to be helping Grace grade labs, so you may get them quicker once she and I work
yep.
that out.
So really, we'll help you catch up. We'll do whatever we can to assist you. Yep, he's graduated. John is an official instructor, so he will be helping me grade your labs. So if you see labs from him, that's good. And you've got two people to help you with labs. You've got Sean and I, and Sean has basically said to about everybody on his Ventrilo server, which is more of a commitment than I've actually got, probably because I have working hours, that he will, if you call him and you want help with your labs, he will drop what he's doing and help you. And he's in your time zone.
Even if I'm on my iPod. If I can, I will do.
So have we told everybody that he's graduated? Congratulations!
Yes! Yeah. Yep. Congratulations, Sean! He's an instructor
well done.
Now. I will also help you out, but I'm not on your time zone. And if you message me and I am not doing something, or I am doing something that I can drop easily, I will definitely help you out. You can also set up a time to work with either Sean or I, whatever you want to do. Honestly, 90% of the time, I'm available to you guys, and you can definitely message me, and I will help you guys out.
Also, this server is available 24 hours a day, and if you students would like to liaise with each other and work on things together on the server, we certainly would not frown on that. So keep in mind, this server is available for you, just part of your QCAT experience.
Okay. Any questions on any labs that anyone has right now? Does everybody understand which labs they need to do for Chapter 5?
Can I just ask, you've already answered this for me, I think, Grace, anyway, but just in case. With 5 points, the upgrade hardware one, does it matter, for instance, if we have two drives that are the same brand, if we can't find any alternative
nope.
to it?
No, it doesn't.
The other thing that came up was that desktop drives are usually 3.5 inches in size, and laptop drives are usually 2.5 inches in size. And yes, there are adapters that will let you put 2.5-inch drives into desktops, which make them quieter and stuff. So that's something else that came up.
Oh, wow.
Those.
Sweet.
Yeah. Another thing, if you have trouble finding a certain component, like a hardware, or like a hard drive, and you... can think of an alternative way of getting a hard drive into a computer, you can use that alternative way. You might have to buy another adapter card, hint, hint, but you can do it.
The only other thing that's pending is that if you do put laptop drives into computers, they do tend to be cooler and quieter, but keep in mind most of the noise from your computer comes from its fan, not its hard drive.
I would rather
I can't even hear my hard drive myself.
Me too.
Well, one of our students has just got a very nice quad-core AMD box that has just been built for her, and she's just started using that last night. And let me assure you, it's so fast it leaves skid marks on the desktop. It's really fast.
I have one of those.
I want one of them.
Oh, yeah, they're good.
Pretty cheap, too, actually. It's amazing.
Okay. Any other questions on the labs? Oh... Me too, I'd dead like one. Mine's sitting in America, not being used, gathering dust. It's awful.
Oh, that's a tragedy.
I just ordered a new dual core machine.
That's still going to be really fast. You're not going to miss out on much speed there.
Yeah, but then when Jaws does 3 cores of your quad core, you've still got one left.
Pretty much, yeah.
Any other questions on labs?
I thought they built that 8-core supercomputer because one of the users was blind and Jaws needed 7 of them.
That's right.
Something like that.
If you have lab questions, don't forget you can email your instructors, and you can email Sean, or you can email Grace, or you can email the instructor's alias, but if you've got Sean's and Grace's emails, you can email them directly. And if Sean doesn't know something, he'll ask Grace. And if Grace doesn't know something, she'll ask me.
Yeah, it's a logical progression here.
I've got a bit of an old question. What's the technical name for the RAM slot that has a lever at both ends that you push down? Is that the zero force insertion that you push down
no.
both levers to pop the RAM out?
The zero force insertion is for your your CPU.
Processor,
CPU, yep. What you need to know for the lab is what type of memory it is. Is it a DIMM? Is it like a DDR1 slot? Is it a DDR2 slot? What type of memory is it that you're working with?
The levers are technically known as retaining levers, I believe, and they are the little levers on the edges of anything that is a DIMM, SDRAM socket or better. They're the two levers that fold out to the edges. Don't forget that if you've got something that's old enough to have SIMS in it, you probably want to upgrade. But it actually has little spring-loaded clips.
Okay. That was someone else that had that computer, but.
Yeah, so what you want to know is it DDR1 or DDR2 or SDRAM? What is it? What kind of RAM is going into that slot?
And Carol has DDR3 memory, just in case she wanted to know.
Well, does it have? Can the answer be very accurate? Would smoky RAM be accepted?
You know what? From you, I'll take it. It's gone now. I can't find out. We'll do just fine. okay.
Barbecue with a side order and processor.
Yeah, basically. That computer's done. Okay. So, yep. Another thing, if you have not finished 1.4.7, anyone, because there are a couple of you who haven't, please do that by next week so I can have grades in the gradebook for you and so that it can be out of your life. There are quite a few of you who haven't finished that lab. Just maybe do that, and then we will basically be done with it, and it'll be good.
And we have a spreadsheet. We know what you've done.
If you're not sure what you've done and what you haven't, write me and I'll send you your gradebook. Any other questions?
I actually do have one. When you're putting the chapter exams up for a week, are we presuming that we're sort of knocking off the chapter exams as we finish each chapter?
Yep.
It's a really good idea to do it that way.
Yep. They will all be up every week. And if you, as you finish your chapter, you're welcome to knock off that exam. If you've read the material and are all good with it, you're welcome to go ahead and do it beforehand. If you don't do so hot on an exam, let us know right away, because we will sit down and review that exam with you.
What is, or rather was, the reason for individually activating the exam?
For everything but the skills test finals and practice finals, I click a button and it's all there.
For everyone.
For everyone.
I need to do more exams.
You do. So, if you need... If you need help, let me know, and I will go over your exams with you, and I will show Sean how to go over exams with you in case I am not available to do so. But just let us know right away. If you get a, let's say, 80...
Oh, I can't wait for that.
It's not that hard. If you get an 80 or below... and you want to know how you did, let us know. Okay. So, any other questions about exams, labs, any of that?
Just a little point. The labs are required. If you haven't done your labs, you are not going to pass. And we have been known in the past to actually fail students who've not submitted any lab work. It has been done. It makes us very sad, and we go to the pub for a couple of hours and drink a lot.
Failing people for not doing their work?
Yes, it happens.
What kind of commune are you running? This communistic, socialistic...
The course feedback also has to be
can't
done.
Deal with it.
But we'll get there when we
Oh, go. Come on, you dealt with it last semester, Drew, and you got your stuff in, so I think you can deal with
yes,
it.
Yes, you did.
Yes.
Don't feel bad if you're behind. It's just time to catch up now. It's nothing to worry, you know, be ashamed of or worry about. Just catch up.
However, if something happens like the world turns upside down and stuff. Also, let us know, like, if something really bad happens. You don't actually have to tell us what the really bad thing was, but if you just say, really busy bad stuff is happening right now, and I'll get to my labs next week, we will give you until next week to do that.
Curtains on.
Life does happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Slowly
well,
the bathroom ceiling. That's real
fun
to deal with.
Oh, yeah. And his computer got stolen, and he had actually done a few labs that we were pretty sure we'd seen from him, but didn't have any marks in the gradebook, and we actually didn't have him do those couple over because we'd seen them, and we just weren't able to locate them, and we passed him, and we gave him more time to do his labs, and we helped him catch up, and it was all good.
Yes, they will actually do that stuff, if you really need.
Also, the only other final thing is if you get a lab back and we say, or they say, because I'm not actually your instructor, it's wrong, that gives you another chance to resubmit it and you don't lose marks. We would like to see you pass all the labs. We are not interested in having you all pass the labs the first time, although we'd love to see you do that.
And no shame in failing a lab, guys. It's okay. Just do it over and do it over as soon as possible so that it's fresh in your mind and we can pass you on it.
We all do it. Even I've done it. Yes, even me.
Everybody's done it. I've failed labs before. Yeah. So, all right.
Onwards and downwards.
Absolutely. Okay, so the recovery partition... many manufacturers that actually have the operating system installed for you create you a recovery partition. And you can use this to actually recover your settings from exactly the way they built it. So you're not going to get anything but exactly what they put on your computer. So that means if Norton Internet Security was on there, when you first got it, it's going to be back on there again. So, yep.
Just another quick point here. There are some manufacturers, and I don't know whether she's going to mention this because I haven't read her notes yet, that also give you the option of making recovery disks when you first get the computer. Don't put it off. Don't think you'll do it next week. Go on down to the store and get the media and put it in the optical drive and do it. Because let me assure you that at $100 to $200 for the replacement discs from the manufacturer, you'll wish you really made it on your own media because it was so much cheaper. The OEM copy of the operating system that comes with your machine is licensed specifically to that machine. It can't be installed on six others and your mates down the street. But some of the OEM agreements say that you must make the recovery media, otherwise you must pay the high replacement costs from the manufacturer. I've known people who've had to do it. It's not fun.
In my day job, we do adaptive technology systems, and we do put a recovery partition because it saves me a tremendous amount of headache. But I also, on every system, we make optical media because there have been enough cases where within the first 2 months we had a dead hard drive, and your recovery partition won't help you if you have a dead hard drive.
This is quite true.
IBM will charge $26 for... They're at least void about 40.
Yeah, HP is 16 or so.
Some of the people are a lot more expensive. I think Toshiba can be a lot more expensive. And the other thing is you also need to be able to read the model numbers and things off the computer, the exact model numbers, so that they can send you the right disks. And if you don't have sighted assistance, that can be quite difficult. And if the model numbers have rubbed off, that can also be a problem because they need to send you the right disks for the right machine or it won't go. So keep that in mind. We will talk about some imaging solutions, probably not today, but there are some fairly good imaging solutions that we can actually access. So there's something that, to look forward to.
That'll probably be Module 12 when we come back to operating systems. Okay, so in some of your computers, this partition is hidden and you have to press a special key combination to get the recovery media to the recovery partition to actually happen. If you don't know how to access this partition, contact the manufacturer, look at their website, read your computer manual to figure out how this is done.
Or press every function key during post until something comes up that says recovering computer and be very happy with yourself. No, that is really a last resort, guys, but that's usually what we do. You boot it up and you go F6, F7, F8, F9, F10. Ooh, got it.
F11! Which it usually is F11.
Is F12. We had to gateways F11. Three ones. Oh, okay. And so that was 12. We had to repartition. We did the drive because SP3 messed up on my friend's Dell machine once. That was fun.
Woo! Good times. Okay.
What's the purpose of the repartition? Exactly.
Huh?
Sorry, you're a bit quiet. What's Curtis, that? Can you sort of lean over that microphone a bit more? Sorry, we're having trouble picking you out because you've got a bit of ambient echo in there.
What's the purpose of the recovery partition?
The recovery partition stores an image of the initial computer setup. In other words, the initial operating system install. Some of them are an exact image, so some of them actually unghost the literal operating system onto the primary partition so that when you boot the machine, it comes up and boots. Others actually unghost a pre-activated OEM install of Windows, so it actually unghosts itself, reboots, installs a pile of drivers, reboots, and comes up to the desktop. So the recovery partition is for recovering your system to the factory or ship out state of the machine. And if your data is on the C drive, and in certain circumstances some of the recovery things will actually take away all the partitions, your data is gone. So don't recover your machine unless you have good backups of your data.
Or unless you really have no other choice and it's just gone. Does that explain it?
Yeah, so if you have to reload Windows, if you have no other choice, you can do that recovery partition.
If your computer was pre-installed with an operating system and your manufacturer actually included it, you can. What's going to happen is that you will get back exactly what was on your computer the very first time you ever booted it up.
I think what you're talking about is
including the out of box.
In a different perspective. I once had to do that to my Toshiba, and the option was literally called restore to out-of-box condition. So,
yeah, that's literally what you're doing.
Although luckily for Toshiba users, there is actually an option to restore the C drive and leave any D partition alone, and it also exists for Asus, but don't rely on it, because some of them don't have that option.
I don't think mine did.
You didn't have a D drive.
Speaking of Asus, do they have cooling pads for netbooks? Because my netbook keeps overheating, and I've got a cooler.
You need to get. You can get any generic cooling pad. Like Radio Shack will help you. eBay will help you. It doesn't need to be an Acer cooling pad. You just need one for the size of the netbook you've got.
If it is overheating, though, that is a significant problem, and I'd be looking into it because they shouldn't overheat, not at least until you get up to about 90 degrees Fahrenheit. If you get over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, I'd be worried about overheating, but it shouldn't overheat that badly, and that could...
Acers are overheat.
Yeah, I've noticed that with mine. I've got a cooling fan, but it was for a bigger laptop, and I'm going to say ever since I had it, it won't do it every time, and it might take a couple hours, but I'll be sitting there doing something, and all of a sudden, and restart.
Yeah. Anyway, off topic.
It just gets hot.
We've got to get back on topic. Sorry. Because I want to get done with this lovely thing. And we get the boot process. Okay, very testable in the A+. Now, what you're going to have to do is put these steps in order. So you want to memorize the order of the steps. You probably won't have to actually do much else with it, but you need to know the order. So very testable, something that you guys need to know. And I'm very proud of the notes I took on this.
It's not actually in the test.
No, they took it out.
They took it out, but it is in the A+.
There's a video that I can forward back. Elise posted it months ago, and I kept it.
That was good.
I can give you that again, or send it back.
Okay, so the first step of the booting process is to turn on the computer. This is called a cold boot. When you actually restart your computer, that is called a warm boot. Next, the computer performs a power on self-test, or POST. This checks that the main hardware components of the computer are working properly. After the POST, BIOS reads the configuration files located in CMOS. The boot device priority tells your computer in what order to check devices for something to boot. This can be set in the BIOS. Refer to Lab 3.9.2. If a device has no bootable media, what happens?
If it's an IBM, it drops into ROM Basic.
You get a message usually that says, system, operating system not found or something like that.
No, you don't. Go ahead, Carol. Carol has something to say. Yeah, it is. Go ahead. Hold it down and talk.
It looks for the next device.
Absolutely. Next device drive. Either way, that's absolutely right. When one device does not have bootable media, it passes it by and moves on to the next device. No, just one.
No, the question you asked was, what happens if there is no bootable media at all? And that was the question.
Yeah, that's
what
you asked.
Oh, okay, sorry.
That is what you
asked. Okay, so let's work through an example here. All right. If the boot order were floppy drive, optical drive, and hard drive, and there's no media in the floppy drive, an MP3 mix you made last week in the optical drive, and Windows OS on the hard drive, what happens?
Boot from the hard drive, because the other two don't have any bootable media.
That's
Can
absolutely right. That MP3...
So in thinking that because there's something in the optical drive, it should be able to boot from it, and it kind of gets stuck in a loop because it can't? Or you get some...
No.
You get some dialogue pop-up that's inaccessible because you don't have screen reader or something?
No, it bypasses it. If it doesn't see an Eldorado boot sequence, and it is called an Eldorado boot sequence on the optical media, it bypasses it as a boot device, and there are no dialogues that says, "Oi, your MP3 mix is in the drive, and you didn't pull it out."
Yeah.
It just moves on. It just goes on to the next device. However, some BIOSes do throw up a message that say, if no bootable media is found, it says, "No bootable media found. Please either plug bootable USB thumb drive or insert bootable media and reboot machine." And that's actually what Carol's machine says if you don't have any bootable media.
Go ahead, Marshall.
Yeah, you also get into real fun if you have non-bootable media in the A drive.
Yep.
Because I don't know if it's all of these, but I ran into that once and it drove me nuts.
Okay. If you have a floppy drive or a thumb drive plugged in, it will skip optical drives. Some BIOSes will not skip a hard drive or a floppy drive that is external. If you get the error, non-system disk, don't panic. Just reach down and take that floppy or thumb drive out of the computer and restart it, and it'll all be okay.
If you get the error non-system disk when you've unplugged all these, then...
Then you panic.
There used to be a little thing out there called Bootminder, and my dad had this on Windows 95, and it ran, when you shut down the computer, it would, if it noticed a disk in, it would tell you to take it out. But that
Norton,
was when the computers didn't automatically shut down.
Norton antivirus used to do that as well. It used to check floppy drives and removable drives on shutdown, just in case there was something that was
nuts.
In there that shouldn't be.
Okay. You can also have network or flash drives, or even SD cards in the boot order. So if you've got something in there that, like a hard drive or network drive or flash drive, that may halt your computer from booting because there is a boot sector or something it thinks is a boot sector on those particular disks, and your BIOS has just decided that it's not going to boot. So we just unplug those and go on. A lot of new ones don't do this. A lot of new ones will just skip them. Many computers have a key or key combination that you can press before the boot sequence starts to manually select which device you want to boot for that particular computer session. So once you restart your computer, this setting doesn't apply and it's going to go back through this process all over again. But for a once-off, I want to boot something different, you press this key combination. It's really good for things like Vinix Live CDs. If you don't have a sighted person around to help you change the boot order and you want to boot that CD. Okay, so once a bootable device is found, the BIOS locates its master boot record, MBR. The MBR locates the operating system bootloader, which in XP is called NTLODER. This question's in one of your tests somewhere. Don't think it's actually in Chapter 5.
I thought it was NTLD.
Yeah, I thought it was too. Yeah, it is. The actual file is called NTLDR.exe or something. See?
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, it is called that. That's if you're booting an operating system that is Windows NT-like or an XP Vista 7 derivative thing.
At this point, NTLDR takes over the boot sequence. If there is more than one operating system present on the media, It's going to look at boot.ini, which prompts you to choose the operating system you would like to launch. To change the operating system from the default, press down arrow. Otherwise, just wait. Boot.ini will eventually time out, and the process will continue. If there's only one operating system present on a particular media device, this step is skipped. So, to clarify, if you've got a Vinix thumb drive in and you have a hard drive in, it's not going to, boot.ini is only going to look at the hard drive to see which operating systems are on it. It only looks at the one device at this point, not both. So if you have two operating systems on one hard drive, then you're going to get this menu. If you have two on separate devices, you won't. Does that make sense?
It's called the Windows Boot Manager, and most people who put multiple operating systems on, the first thing they do is bypass it, so the only thing it ever does is load Windows. But it is actually possible to put other operating systems into that Boot Manager if you really think you want to.
Okay, so if we've got one operating system only, this is skipped. Next, NTLDR runs ntdetect.com, which gathers information about installed hardware. Next, the NTLDR finds the path specified in boot.ini to locate the boot partition and launches two files that make up the core of XP. These are in your test. ntoscrnl.exe and hal.dll. Didn't I say that?
No, you said C. It's K for kernel.
NTLDR. Yes, okay. They are ntoskrnl.exe and hal.dll.
HAL stands for Hardware Abstraction Layer, if anybody cares.
NTLDR reads the registry files. It chooses the hardware profile and loads the device drivers. The Windows registry files are an important part of the Windows XP boot process. These files are recognized by their distinctive names, which begin with HKEY, followed by the name of the part of the operating system that they control. Every setting in Windows, from backgrounds of the desktop and the colors of the screen, buttons, licensings of applications, is stored in the registry. When a user makes changes to control panel settings, file associations, system policies, or install software, the changes are stored in the registry. Each user has a unique section of the registry. The Windows login process pulls system settings from the registry to reconfigure the systems to the state that it was last in when that user logged down. Anyone ever have a computer that says loading your personal settings or saving your personal settings when you turn it on and off? Well, that's what's happening. The registry is saving your system state, and it is pulling that back when you load up your computer.
It's worth noting that when Windows does this, it does copy the Hive into a thing called HKeyCurrentUser, but in the actual registry files, it's actually under HKey and a really weird user ID that absolutely has no relevance to your username, so you need to map the username across to this bizarre number before you can find that registry Hive for that particular user. I hope none of you ever have to do this.
Okay, at this point, NT...
Have you got find command in the registries for...
Yeah. This ntkernel.exe that you loaded earlier takes over. This is the heart of the operating system, and this file starts winlogin.exe, which allows you to log on to your computer. Any questions about the boot process before we talk about customizing our computers?
I suppose really all you can do is just read over it and read over it and read over it until you memorize it. I think that's what I'm going to need to do anyway.
Oh, that's basically about it, yeah. And
I didn't
that's something you definitely.
The whole thing.
I mean, I can put them in order, and I could probably actually recite it if I really wanted to, but you know what? I don't. So, there you go. Okay. So now that we've booted the computer, we are going to configure it. There are many utilities in Windows that allow you to customize your computer. the best thing to do, guys, is explore. A lot of this, most of you will already know. We're going to review it quickly. And definitely explore and have a look around these different utilities. If you have any questions about them, ask us, talk to us on Discuss. But we're going to assume that you know a lot of this already and that you have played around with your computers a fair bit.
If you are going to play with some of these utilities, you might want to do it on a virtual machine, however, if you don't know what they do. Things like RegEdit are particularly dangerous.
Yeah. We're okay, msconfig allows you to choose which programs and services start at startup and allows you to edit configuration files. This is really good if you've got that program that just keeps bugging you, pulls up Windows, and you really don't want it to come up at startup, but you needed to launch it some other times. Now you can just tell that not to launch at startup. There's a checkbox.
Which never worked on mine.
There is a problem with this, though. When you do that, it does put the thing into system into selective startup mode, because I'm just looking at it here on my screen. And if somebody ever pulls your machine out of selective startup mode without realizing what you've changed, it could crash again. So just be careful of that.
I try to adjust the start when my computer starts in the individual applications when I can, because I just don't want to deal with what Carrie talked about.
This used to be harder to do than it is now. A lot of applications have really cleaned this up because it just annoyed users. I used to use msconfig a whole lot a couple of years ago. I don't even think I've done knocked anything out of my startup order this install of Windows, actually. So.
Oh, I did last week. I'm naughty. The other thing I was going to point out, because we talked about it last week, if you go into the Tools tab of this thing, it actually has a link to the Event Viewer, just because we talked about it last week.
So where is this thing? Say an XP.
Start you run sysedit.
MSconfig
start run MSconfig. Yeah, sorry, sysedit is a different one. My bad.
And you can, in Windows 7, just search for MSconfig. RegEdit. If this breaks, you keep both pieces, so make a backup of your registry. RegEdit allows you to edit your registry. If you're editing the registry, always take a backup first, because if you make a mistake in the registry, it may cause you a lot of grief, and you may even have to reinstall the entire operating system. If you know what you're doing, you'll be okay, though.
I actually remember seeing an article in the Microsoft Knowledge Base that tells you how to back up the registry. I don't actually recall seeing one on how to restore it.
I think there is one. You have to boot into that yucky recovery console and run a weird file that they provide.
Fun.
The other thing about RegEdit that's worth pointing out is that it does not have "Do you wish to save changes?" It presumes that you know what you're doing, and if you make a change and press Alt+F4 to make it go away because you don't want to do that, it saves.
Good point.
Yes, once you actually make the change, they're committed pretty much instantaneously. And that is something to be aware of. You really shouldn't be editing the registry unless you know what you're doing or you're following some specific directions and you trust the person, the article, or the website that gave you those directions. A lot of harm has been done to computers by people editing the registry based on an email their friend sent them, which turned out to be a hoax.
Just be careful. Okay, MS Info 32 displays a complete system summary of your computer, including hardware components and details of installed software and settings.
Can that be dumped to a file?
Yes. However, it's only Windows' idea of what's in the system, not really what's in the system, so you probably want something like Spexy, CPU-Z, or one of the other utilities that tends to do a better job. Bellark probably does a good job too. Can anyone hear Grace? I can't.
No, she's gone if she's talking.
She's gone.
Did you mute it?
Okay, there we go. Somehow I got muted. Okay. I was saying that Bellark is free and really good.
Only for personal use. Just be careful, guys. It's not free for commercial use.
DX.
Those two utilities.
Which two?
CPU Z and Spexy, which is by the same people that do CCleaner. So if you go to peerreform.com, you can get their defragler, their Spexy, and their CCleaner.
This is one we didn't talk about last year, and you'll probably only ever have to use it a handful of times in your life, but trust me, if you're an audio gamer, this is gold. DxDiag. This utility shows details about all of the DirectX components and drivers that are installed in your computer. You can use this utility to ensure that DirectX is installed properly and configured correctly. Does anyone remember that bug in Grizzly Gulch where the shooting actually didn't work until you fixed up something in DxDiag?
Hey, does anybody remember the trauma that was in RS Games' Monopoly client that if you didn't have the latest versions of DirectX, which didn't come down in Windows Update, the game wouldn't run? There were very unhappy wannabe Monopoly players that needed to upgrade their .NET frameworks and DirectX before this thing would fly. And I remember 2 days of sadness on the VT servers. Oh, it's fixed now because they've redone the entire client. But when the first client wasn't written in Python, there were some bad times for the initial gamers.
That was fun to walk people through that were not as experienced, let me tell you.
And some people actually had it where it didn't actually work.
Come down on Windows Update?
No, there are actually updates to DirectX. That are actually that don't come down in Windows Update because DirectX is not seen as an essential system service. So you need to get the latest DirectX runtimes direct from Microsoft if you want the latest drivers for gaming peripherals and sound stuff.
Okay.
I know this is probably off topic, but does that Grizzly Gulch book extend to the rattlesnakes as well? I could never get those.
No. But there was a cheat if you actually. Messed with one setting in your in that DxDiag, you could slow everything down.
What?
I don't remember which setting it was, but yeah.
Yeah, we didn't talk about and that one last.
No, we didn't. And the last utility that we're going to talk about in this section is CMD, which allows you to run command lines and do command line based applications.
And it's very cool for dealing with internet problems.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you can actually do that. There's another nifty thing you can do with command lines that I didn't actually know about until somebody showed me. There's a utility under command prompt called start, which we don't talk about. But you can actually go start space slash priority colon below normal space my big MP3 encode job that's going to take all day. And it will actually re-nice it down so that it doesn't eat all your CPU so that you can get on with doing your word processing while your music encodes. That's not the exact syntax, but you get the idea. Start space slash question mark will give you the goods.
You may have just said that, Luke. I didn't quite hear you, but it can also output the command line results to a text file. Netstat.
Yes, we talk about that a whole lot in exploration. Okay, there are many different modes in which you can boot Windows. Press F8 to access the Windows Advanced Boot menu. Here are some common startup modes. Safe mode starts Windows but only loads drivers for basic components such as the keyboard and display. Safe mode with networking support starts Windows identically to the safe mode and also loads the drivers for network components. Safe mode with command prompt. Yep, I'm getting there. Starts Windows and loads the command prompt instead of the GUI. Unfortunately, safe mode only loads essential drivers so that you have the best chance of troubleshooting. Problem with this is that sound is not considered essential for safe mode, so it's not accessible.
Hang on, is sound still disabled by default on Windows Server 2008? I seem to recall something about that. You've actually got to enable sound on the server if you want it. Is that still true?
Anybody know?
I'm not sure
it's the same in 8.
I would say ask Darren.
Yeah, I will. Because I think, and there were actually some scripts that some Patrick Perdue and a couple of other people came up that would completely automatically bootstrap a virtual Windows 2008 server and do the RDP redirect of all the sound and stuff complete with screen readers. I'm still chasing those resources down, but you could actually run a 2008 server in a data center and be blind and access it. So that might be worth a look.
Last known configuration, also known as really good when it works, enables you to load configuration settings of Windows that were used the last time the Windows was started successfully. It does this by accessing a copy of the registry that is created for this purpose. If you have actually booted up Windows and had a problem and Windows managed to boot, this file is immediately erased. So your last known good configuration may not actually do you any good, and you'll have to resort to more desperate measures.
It may not be a good configuration anymore.
Yeah, it might be the last known some kind of configuration, not necessarily good. If you want to try this, you press K when your machine is booting up.
Now that I didn't.
Okay. Yep.
Is that after you push F8 or just K period?
No, I think it's just K period, but not actually.
It also shows up on the F8 menu as well.
I think it's just K, but it is on the F8. Windows uses a directory tree to manage files and folders. Just to review, the root of this tree is usually called C. Windows creates a set of default files and folders in C. However, you have the ability to create your own folders and organize them however you like. All files must stick to the Windows naming convention. This is testable, and I think somewhere in one of your tests you have some questions about this. The rules of this naming convention are as follows. Maximum of 255 characters can be used. Characters such as slash or backslash are not allowed. An extension of 3 or 4 letters is added to the file name to identify file types. File names are not case sensitive in Windows. If you're working in Linux, they are.
Can I ask, is that why Windows doesn't like the Mac habit of putting dot trashes and dot whatever the hell the other thing is on my removable media? Is that why Windows
spares it? It'll do it. No, you can have dot trashes. The extensions are you don't actually need the extensions under Windows, but Windows itself uses the extensions to recognize the file types. And one of the things that we always mention is remember that Windows uses the first extension if there are two extensions, so you get bobbyscreensaver.scr.exe, you will actually see the screensaver icon even though it's actually an executable. That's a known bug in Windows, and it causes all
viruses
sorts of grief.
Used to
first or second, Carrie, because you just said it's a .exe.
Yeah, it shows the screensaver icon for the .exe file. So it actually shows bobbyscreensaver.scr.exe, and it shows you the screensaver icon.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. There used to be gotcha. I love you.whatever.vbs
that would mess with you pretty
do
well.
Bad things. Some extensions are turning into multi-letters, though. Some applications are using like .paint something. I know PaintShop Pro and so three or four letter is kind of going away. But anyway,
they're usually 3 or 4 letters unless they're not. So the first thing that you want to do. Or one of the first things you want to do is go into your folder options and tell it to not hide extensions for known file types, because then you'll know what you're actually getting yourself into.
The other one I would do if you are an experienced computer user and this is your computer is I would show hidden files by default, and I personally do not hide protected operating system files. But you must take full responsibility for that setting and not delete things that look interesting.
I do that as well. Another good thing is to have the path shown in the title bar.
You have to select not to hide the operating files to do your DRM, like if you're using RFBND books and trying to download them.
Okay. That's safe.
The other
safe.
Thing you may want to do is to, once you've changed those and you've changed it to list view, is to hit apply to all folders, as what I always do.
Yep.
That way they all come up in list and they all come up with some of the things.
All right, so let's go through and name some commonly used file extensions. Anyone?
Whoops. TX.
There you go. Yep.
Yep.
And what is what? Yep. And as you're naming them, tell us what they're actually used for.
Music files or playing, audio or media. Mm-hmm.
COM was an old version of EXE used mostly for DOS programs.
Still used.
Oh, so that's what that is. I was wondering about that when you mentioned it before.
Well, actually, COM isn't actually an .exe file. COM is an executable file that is not relocatable. In other words, it must load into a specific segment of memory. There is a big difference between a .com and a .exe. A .com can be a maximum of 64 kilobytes in size and loads at 100 hex from the beginning of the program segment prefix. I'm done now. An .exe is relocatable.
Wow. That's actually really interesting.
Yeah, because I thought about that when it mentioned the .com and the curriculum. I sort of thought, what is that? So thanks for that.
That's all right. And then .exe is relocatable. There are two versions of .exe. One is the DOS version of .exe, and one is the Windows version of .exe. And if you launch the Windows version of .exe inside of DOS, it says this program requires Microsoft Windows. And the other point that's worth mentioning is that all executables start with the two letters capital M, capital Z, which stands for Mark Zakowski, the guy who invented the .exe file header. Okay.
That's within the file itself, you mean, Harry? Gary?
Yeah.
But not in the name.
Right at the beginning of the file, MZ, Mark Zakowski was his name, and he invented the header.
Okay.
Not on your test. Don't worry about that. That's a batch file.
That's a text file.
How is that different from an actual program?
Okay, well, a batch file is a text file that is run by the command interpreter, usually cmd.exe, although you can force batch files to be run by command.com, but I wouldn't recommend it. There is also .cmd files, which use extended syntax of cmd.exe, and they are editable in Notepad. So you could write something into Notepad that said add echo off, which stops it from echoing the lines to the output, echo, hello, my name is Aiden and I rock. And then you could save that as aidenrocks.bat, and every time you hit enter on it, it would say, hello, my name is Aiden and I rock. And you could even put an exclamation mark on there. But more specifically, you could do things like run robocopy from a batch file that would actually keep a set of files in sync, or run a series of copy commands or archive commands to actually back your system up from your pre-made batch file. They're not covered anymore. We used to actually have labs on writing them.
You don't have to write batch files, guys. I was in 3.1, so we haven't been writing batch files for years in IT.
With a subnote that the first thing I ever did in the command prompt with Grace when she moved over here was help her write a batch file, I think, seems to recall.
Yeah, it was.
I'm actually surprised because I still use them a lot.
A lot of people do. A lot of Linux-y command line type people love them.
It sounds like something I should learn to do.
Yeah, it depends if you have a use for them. They're really good.
Well, command line is really powerful, and I mean, you can do things. You do realize you can shut down your computer from the command line and specify how long it takes to shut down before it shuts down, and a whole bunch of things. That's just one of the things from there. From CMD.
There's actually a book.
How do you do it?
You Google up shut down computer from command line, and it'll give you an article.
Or you type shut down space question mark.
Yeah, that's the other way.
That'll do.
The other thing you can also do is there's a book called Administering Windows Server 2003, Windows 95, 98, 2000 XP from the command prompt. If you can find that book, it's really, really good. And it actually has all sorts of command line tricks that work under all the different operating systems and time-saving techniques for, you know, duplicating user profiles and all sorts of other niftiness. Sean has a headset short and won't be with us at the moment, so we're very sad about that.
I will intermittently be with you.
Okay.
Okay.
Just don't be short with
us,
okay?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Can you restart your computer from the command prompt? Is that possible?
Yes.
Yeah, that's probably one of the...
R.
That's a whole other lecture.
Yeah, you can even make a shortcut on your desktop that says reboot that puppy now, and when you hit enter on it, it will actually run shutdown-r and reboot your computer.
Carrie should probably do a presentation on command line at some point for you guys. I've had some command line work, but I am one of these people who really likes my graphical user interface and is not a huge fan of the command line way of doing things. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'd certainly be interested to hear something like that, just to get sort of a basic understanding of it.
I love the GUI, but I'm really sick of hourglasses.
Well, one of the other things is if you get good at the command prompt, and it's not for everyone, as Grace has just pointed out, you can be an extremely efficient administrator, and you can achieve things that would take sighted people with the mouse hours. And as I said, there was an article, I think I mentioned it last week, there's one called Real Men Don't Click, if you look for that article, you will find all sorts of command line stuff in there as well. I think that site's still up. I'm not sure. I'd have to go and have a look.
Okay. Did I? I muted myself. Oh, okay. Attributes for each... there are attributes that are maintained by the directory structure that control how each file can be viewed or altered. These are the most common file attributes. R, or dash R, is read-only. That means you can't modify it. A, the file will be archived the next time that the disk is backed up. S, the file is marked as a system file, and a warning is given if an attempt is made to delete or modify the file. H, the file is hidden and from the directory display. You can
anybody,
view...
I was just going to say, anybody notice that spelt the word rash in case you're trying to remember them?
Does Windows still you use can... the archive bit?
Windows itself does set the archive bit on file modification, and I believe some of its inbuilt backup utilities can use the archive bit, but usually it's third parties that make use. The archive bit should actually be called the to-be-archived bit, but it's actually called the archive bit. It actually gets set when file content is modified, and that shows an incremental backup solution that these files need to be backed up to offline media.
You can view the file names, extensions, and attributes by entering the attrib command in a DOS or Windows command prompt. use the following path to start the command prompt. Start run CMD, or just type in CMD at your search box if you're a Vista or 7 user.
You'd go, what, attrib? And then the file path, so you colon backslash whatever, or how would you do it?
Normally you would change into the specific directory that contains the file, unless you really feel like typing in the full path. And then you go attrib space dash question mark and read the help screen. And then you go, now I understand that. Attrib space plus R space quote my sister's big document that I don't want her to modify dot doc quote. And hit enter and it will set the read-only attribute. Or seriously, you could do grace method and navigate to it in the GUI, hit alt enter and tick the read-only box in the properties dialog, which is probably what grace would do.
And just much quicker.
Although I could have a nasty batch file that sets a whole stack of things to be read-only every time the system logs in, and that would be kind of cool and not very nice, but somehow useful in certain situations.
You can use wildcards, such as star star, to view many different files at once.
That was star dot star, by the way, people.
Star dot star, yeah. To get information about the attrib command, type
attrib. Anyone who's had anything to do with Braillites will know that one.
Yep. Absolutely. A lot of Braillite stuff was DOS and command line based, and so if you've actually used a Braillite, you'll have a lot of edge on the command line stuff.
I dared my friend to go OCode decode star period star, and then watched him try to exit the file menu and heard it go click. he knew how to recover files though, so okay. My next step would have been to get to dare him to turn the machine off, but I wonder what would have happened then.
That is so mean.
Okay.
Wow. So to get help and to find out what. Which commands? Go ahead.
I was just going to say that one thing about the Braille command is actually, I think it's called the Braille command. It actually is a floppy drive. It actually has a full functioning version of the command line, and it's to the point where you could type in commands and it would actually run things. I don't know if it would actually run DOS programs, but a friend of mine had one of those old things from the. In the 90s, and that was an interesting experience to hear one of those go off.
Okay, so to get help on the attrib command, you are going to type attrib slash question mark. You can access the Windows equivalent of attrib, the GUI equivalent is what they really should say, by right-clicking a file in Windows Explorer or just hitting the Applications key and choosing Properties. And then you can actually go through. You're going to use your JAWS cursor, I believe, and you can check the checkboxes for the attributes?
No, the actual checkboxes are... Yeah, they're in the tab order.
Tab order? Okay. It's the actual system information.
Sizes and
yeah, size and stuff you need the Jell Scores are for.
Ironically, Apple iTunes is more accessible than the Windows properties box because Apple, all the Apple status bar things are each in their own tab control. It's great. You can just tab through it.
Fair enough. As a review, remember that FAT32 and NTFS are both used in XP. In Vista and Windows 7, you don't get a choice. You get NTFS. Have a nice day. NTFS can handle bigger files, provides compression and encryption, and better security settings. You can convert a FAT file system to an NTFS file system in XP by using the convert.exe utility. Make sure to back up all your data before doing this, and be sure you actually want to convert this to an NTFS file system, because if you want to go back, you have to reformat your partition. There's no opposite. There's no NTFS back to FAT32 program. So it
actually
only goes one easy way.
There's none that's bundled, but Partition Magic will do it.
Will that convert thing work on like other drives as well?
It will work on external drives. The problem is, has anybody ever had a convert go bad? It is probably a really good idea to back stuff up. I've never had one go bad, but apparently it can happen. If it crashes in the middle, bad things happen.
As they say in the text, they're very specific about you backing up before you do this. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Have a look at the two diagrams showing the file properties dialogues for a FAT32 and an NTFS file. They're actually really interesting. And you get to do a lab, a very cool lab, in Chapter 12 on how to convert a FAT32 to an NTFS partition. And convert.x is in one of your tests. So make sure you remember that's how you do it.
Another point is the largest file size on FAT32 is 4 gigabytes, which means that if you are using Nero and trying to copy a DVD and which has more than 4 gig on it, the copy will fail on a FAT32 file system. That has bitten more people than you can possibly imagine.
You have a lab here that is about answering questions about the FAT32 versus the NTFS file system. And now, honestly, a really good place to find information about this is Wikipedia, because all of the information is not in your notes.
Also, Wikipedia is the easiest. There are also articles in the Microsoft Knowledge Base that cover the different file systems that will give you the information as well. We will accept Wikipedia, however.
Yeah, they actually have a really good article about it. Go ahead.
As long as it's referenced, didn't you once say we needed to reference?
I'd like you to reference it. I'd like you to.
Wikipedia?
No, I'd like you to. Because if you get something completely wrong, then I can look at where you got the information from and say, hey, either you interpreted this wrong and this is why, or wow, this article is completely actually wrong, and I can point it out to you and help you find the right information.
I was crazy and like gave links for everything I found, like every product page, every Wikipedia, and just because I'm that kind of person, I was like, you know what?
And it makes life so much easier, because if Sean got something wrong, I could look it up and go back to him and say, you got this wrong, and here's why. And here's what it actually means by this particular sentence on the webpage.
Now, when we say reference, we do not need you to do year date reference or www.yada-yada-yada, retrieve
no MLA,
that, blah,
no
blah,
APA,
blah.
No,
we just want
just
you to put the links
provide
in.
Provide a link.
But also, Grace, what you're saying about what Sean did, I mean, I should do that as well, because if you ever want to go back to your labs, like, there was some reason why I wanted to actually go back and look up something in one of my labs, and I read through the whole lab, and it had that piece of information there, but it didn't actually have the link to where I found it, which it wasn't that information I was looking for. It was something else from the same source, and bugger if I could find it again. So it really does help.
Yeah, it does help you. I think everybody should do it. I'd like everybody to do it. If you don't, you're not going to get marked off for it, though. It's just very helpful for me and you and everybody.
And Brian, I think, wanted to say something, possibly.
Go ahead, Brian.
I did, but I can wait my turn. Just while we're on the fun of NTFS properties, Has anyone ever figured out a way to change the cluster size? Because my netbook came with 64K clusters, and it's very full of little tiny files that are each taking up 64K, and I could probably save a ton of space by shrinking the clusters, but I haven't found an easy way to do that.
I don't think Petition Magic will let you... I don't think it'll let you change the cluster size. It'll let you set the cluster size on format. No, I think it does let you change the cluster size. But you're going to have to do it off some sort of other sort of media. You're going to have to either get a Windows pre-execution environment and boot it from there, or use a DOS version of Petition Magic to change the cluster size. I don't know whether any of the NTFS funky utilities for Linux can change the cluster size, but it'd be a bit risky.
Actually, you might try Partition Magic, because I think it might just have you reboot.
Oh, no. No, this one's nasty.
No?
On the boot drive, it's got to change the cluster size on everything, and there are things that Partition Magic can't do, because once it changed the cluster size on the partition it's come up from, it's like chopping the tree branch out from under you. You can't...
Ah, fair enough.
It's like you can grow...
Was that a solid-state drive?
No, it's actually a 160-gig SATA drive. Can you get Partition Magic? Because I have this horrible Paragon thing that actually works very well, but the GUI is very ugly, and you have to do a lot of mouse cursor things, and I would love something that's nicer.
You can actually get... I think you can actually still get it off Amazon, of all places. If you want a legit Partition Magic, I believe Amazon is the place to get it, and I think it's like about $10 or $20. It's quite cheap. It's accessible, yes. DOS edition isn't, though, which is a bit of a problem if you're doing repair work. I'll see if I can rat up another way of changing the cluster sizes, because I agree, 64K clusters on a 160-gig drive is highly wasteful.
What are they usually? What's the default, like, for my machine, for instance, Windows 7?
Depends on the formatting utility done and the operating system rules. Partitions under 30 gigabytes in size usually have 5 12-byte clusters, whereas partitions between 30 gigabytes and some number that I can't remember because I haven't read the article recently have 4K clusters, and there's actually a table in one of the Microsoft Knowledge Base articles that will give you all the default cluster sizes. If you would like to know your cluster size right now and you can't wait and Google just seems too hard, you can run the chkdsk utility at your command prompt without the /f option, and it will tell you what the cluster size is down the bottom of the output display. I think there's another way, but I can't remember what it is.
But it's probably smaller than 64K.
You'd hope so. Otherwise, you might be in Brian's boat.
Absolutely. Okay. So, are we done with actually... GUI and converting, or not GUI, NTFS and converting to another file system?
I believe we are. If anybody's interested in on a Friday discussion, if anybody's interested in a Friday, are we done with converting and that sort of thing, and NTFS versus FAT32, she was asking. I might actually, on a Friday chat, talk about... Thursday for you US people, NTFS cloning your file systems for fun and profit. I think that would probably be a worthwhile presentation to give on how I clone up NTFS file systems and how I back up and restore them with netbooks and things, because some people might find that useful.
I think I was going to do the DVD thing tomorrow. Did you still want to do that, or can we move that to somewhere else? Because I don't care.
Yeah, you can do that if you want to. Okay, I just have to announce it.
Fair enough. Yeah, that sounds good.
You also do DVD. Which DVD one? What were you? Which
DVD audio extractor?
Program? Oh.
Yeah. Nice. I hadn't actually been told anything about this, but I'm quite happy to see that go ahead.
Sorry.
I didn't know that you were. I didn't know you were ready to do it this week. But yeah.
Oh yeah, I could have. Oh, it was easy. I mentioned it last week. Yeah, it's so easy. Like, it barely even needs to be done. But it's just a program I know very well and can talk about the ins and outs and stuff.
Okay.
You suddenly
going to
get the presentations, Drew?
I am, it's true. It's a drug, man.
He has a presentation that starts tomorrow.
And if anyone else wants a shot at giving a presentation, let me know, and I'll set you up a slot. Okay. So, now that we've done that and talked about converting, we're going to talk about customizing the graphical user interface. Woo! All right. Most of this you guys probably already know, so this will be quick. A desktop on a computer is a graphical representation of a workspace. It can be customized to suit your needs and preferences. The images, sounds, and colors that you use to customize your desktop are known collectively as a theme. Windows Vista has a special theme called Arrow. And Arrow is the default theme and has translucent window borders and numerous animations and live icons that are thumbnails, images of contents of a file. Because of the advanced graphic needs of Arrow, and that it's a complete and total memory hog, this theme can only be used on computers that meet certain hardware requirements. Screen readers disable Arrow by default, fortunately for us, and Windows Vista Basic does not include it.
Neither does Windows 7 Basic, just so that you know, the starter edition of Windows 7 doesn't include it either.
I wasn't sure that Windows 7 still used Arrow. I think
it does.
I think it wasn't sure if it did or didn't. I just know
we never see it because we put a screen
reader. Yeah, I just know that thankfully my screen reader makes sure it goes away right quick. In Windows Vista, there's also a sidebar that you can customize. My favorite customization for this is to turn it off. This contains little programs called gadgets, which can make things such as clocks, sticky notes, and access to web interfaces such as social networking appear right in your sidebar.
This is a bit like the Mac concept of adding those bizarro things to your dock that everybody goes through before they then take the dock back to how it used to be.
Dashboard. It's a bit like a dashboard, isn't it?
Has anyone...
pretty much a pile on...
Has anyone ever actually found any good uses for sidebar?
I have a couple on mine. I have a currency converter and a world clock. Other than that, no.
Okay, well, hey, that's more use than I've ever seen anyone else put it to, so cool.
Wouldn't that be better off in the system tray?
Not necessarily.
No, you can only put gadgets in the sidebar. So these are special little programs made for your sidebar.
I don't even think I have my sidebar on. I haven't seen it since I put the classic theme up.
That's one of the first things I get rid of.
I believe they call them the only reason, you get them the only reason I, gallery.
Go ahead. The only reason you do what?
I put one was for the currency converter. Because I do a lot of transacting things in different monies.
So my Windows 7 install came with folding at home. I found that amusing.
That's pretty cool. That's actually a good use of a sidebar. I just could never think of anything that was accessible or that I actually wanted on it, so I just got rid of it.
I have a question. What's a good world clock that I could go download? What's a good world clock that I could go download?
Weren't there some JAWS scripts that if you... Sorry, go ahead, Brian.
I think you probably have a better option. What you're going to say, the one that comes with Windows is not bad, but I think your option is better.
There's a set of JAWS scripts which I'll have to dig up. I know the person who wrote them, where if you hit Insert F12 twice quickly, it will give you a list of time zones, and you can then arrow down to the time zone, and it'll tell you what time it is in that time zone. And it actually pulls the information from the time zone keys in the registry. So I'll have to have a Google
around for that.
Yeah, if you want to do like the whole sync to atomic clock thing, then just use the regular clock because it does that now.
Those scripts require a lot of messing around with your default scripts. If you are not comfortable with that process, do not use them. You can really screw things up.
Yeah, you probably can because that is a pretty custom bind hotkey to actually stick it into that. I'll check because I know the person who wrote them, and this might be a different set of scripts. This guy's now in Chile, and maybe he's rewritten them to not require so much dependence.
Yeah, it probably is that.
Yeah, that's one of them. But yeah, so be careful with that. Seriously, probably the best option I've actually found for a world clock at the moment, to be honest, is the iThing has a good world clock on it.
Yeah. Okay, to customize the Windows GUI of your desktop, right-click an empty space on the desktop and choose... properties.
Ah, now guys, I always wondered how to do this for years and years and years and years, and I finally figured it out the other day. You actually When you actually are on the desktop, you actually hit Control Space to unselect whatever's selected by default, and then you right click and it will actually pull these menus up. You don't have to Jaws cursor to do it. I always thought you did.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. In Windows 7, that's all taken away from you, though. Because once you select something, you can't unselect anything. Unless somebody knows something I don't and would like to share it here. Because I'd love to know how to do it with Windows 7.
Escape doesn't work? I'm sure you've tried.
No. Well, you can get to the start menu, but that's not what you want.
No. That's also how
there's another way to do it.
Shortcuts on your desktop. We used to have to do that at the blind school because the CD-ROM was not accessible through my computer the way they did it. So what we'd do is just make a shortcut to D:, and call it CD-ROM disk. And
there's another way to do it.
My control space worked. I tried control space and it unselected.
Really?
Yeah, that works.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah.
What on 7?
Windows 7 Pro.
That does work. You used to be able to just hit a spacebar on it. On Windows XP, you can just hit spacebar or hit F5.
I've always done control space.
And...
No, okay. Hitting spacebar does not work. Spacebar is actually the select key. It's got to be control space.
Okay. You used to also be able to hit F5 on Windows XP, and that would make sure that everything was not selected. That does not do that anymore in 7.
That does work under XP for anyone who cares, but it does actually cause a desktop refresh, which if you're working over a Citrix terminal session, I would not recommend.
All right, so we click on an empty space on the desktop. The control space is probably the most reliable way to do it between all operating systems, as we found out. And you find properties. And you have the display properties window appear, which has 5 tabs. We move between these tabs by hitting control tab. You've got screensaver, appearance, themes, desktop, and settings. You can click any of these display tabs to customize the settings. And you can play around with these and explore them and have a look, because you can customize a whole lot of stuff in them.
Yes, no question. Can you add themes to Windows 7? Anybody know? There was all these themes that you used to be able to add to, like, 98
think
and stuff.
So.
But it sort of got harder.
Yeah
yes, sure. You can.
It comes with a bunch of them already.
I'm talking about add themes, you know.
Yeah, you can add themes, because I've seen a bunch of them on torrent sites, so, you know, they're around. Get this theme, get that theme. Have the Nike shoe theme, you know.
I'd like to stamp that stuff out if I could. Right. Okay, just a shoe part.
Okay. In Windows... Go ahead, Luke.
Is that where I would disable the screensaver entirely? Because I want to do that for my VM.
Yes.
Yes, that's exactly where you'd go do that.
Or you could go to display under control panel, which might be easier to do, although maybe not as quick. You go start settings, control panel, switch to classic view, D twice for display.
Oh,
not on 7, though.
It's there.
Not on 7. We're going to talk about what we do in 7.
I hate that control panel with the fire of 1,000.
Oh, really? I've gotten used to it.
Yeah, I don't like it either.
So, instead of your classic list views in 7, and in Vista... Yeah. In Vista, you can change this to classic, but honestly don't, because you need to get used to this, because this, you have no... There's no go back.
Drink the Kool-Aid.
For this on the Windows 7.
Yeah.
Everything in the control panel is now links. And everything in the personalized dialog box is now links. So, this is fun.
The world is a web page.
Do you get links list?
No. I don't think so. I've never actually tried
it. It's a list of links without a virtual buffer.
What if
it's all the worst parts of a web page with none of the best parts.
Hang on. What if you do insert Z and try and get one?
It won't.
Because that's what I used to do in user account, is you could hit insert Z and
get
a web page. Try it. That'd be fun.
I'll try it right now, but I don't think it'll work.
That'd be amazing if it did. Okay, so you type in personalize in the start menu, and you go to Windows Color and Appearance. Desktop background. You've got, like, these are the tabs in here. These are the links that you can choose. You've got 7 of them. Windows Color and Appearance, Desktop Backgrounds, Screensaver, Sound, Mouse Pointers, Themes, and Display Settings. Click any of these links to customize your display settings.
Just a couple of handy hints here. If you're dealing with low vision people, I'll be really quick about this. Mouse pointers, you can make them really big and turn on mouse trails. They love that.
And no, that doesn't work.
Okay.
Oh, does work under XP, though. I just discovered that. It says application mode auto virtual cursor on. It's unusual.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it goes pop.
It's good in user accounts is where I used to do that all the
time. Yeah.
To customize any item on the desktop, right-click and select properties. And you'll be able to customize that particular item. Hey, does everybody know how the start menu works?
Yeah.
Any questions on how it's... No? Okay.
Just kidding.
Also
just
different
kidding.
In Vista.
Okay. It's a little bit different. In Vista 7, you get a start... I thought you were serious. You said that so deadpan. That was awesome, Curtis. Okay. So in Windows Vista 7, you have a search box. You can get to the All Programs menu by using your arrow keys. You'll find the All Programs menu. It's a tree view. It's lovely.
It's like a mixed tree view edit field bonanza thing.
Hybrid.
I don't even know
something.
What you call it. Yeah.
It is really
honestly,
weird.
Honestly, I try to use it as little as possible. I just use the search box, key in a few letters.
Yeah, I love this. I do
down.
Love the search
box. It's somewhere
box.
In there. Me too. I'm a search box addict.
Am I the only one that's spent?
A search box and a control panel too.
Yeah, there is one there.
Oh, there is.
Am I the only one that spent 15 minutes looking for the shutdown button under Windows Vista / 7?
Nope,
and I realized
I did
that it was nope. Right arrow from the start menu. It's like, that's where it's hiding now.
Yeah,
I was worse. I didn't even realize that. I had to get Grace to tell me to Alt F4 the disk.
Yes, I am. That's what I recommend people do in Windows Vista 7. Go to your desktop, hit
the
Alt F4.
Button on my computer. I cheat.
Yeah, okay.
So do I half the time. Is
it's a soft shutdown, you know.
Yeah, actually there can be. When you hit the turn off button, it's going to try to shut down the items cleanly, but it might not have enough time to do so. So all of your settings may not be saved. So you can hit that turn off button.
That's a setting you can set on shutting down, whether or not you want it to just exit everything immediately or if you want it to wait.
Windows 7 is a little cleaner about it then.
Windows
7 you can do
computer,
it, but it's hidden. I don't know.
Not a great
it.
Idea. Windows 7 is cleaner about it and will. Sorry.
No, it's okay. You also don't want to hold down. If you hold down the turn off button, that is like powering the computer eventually.
Turn it off.
I've had to do this. My computer's crashed so many times. I'm an expert.
That is my I am the master, not you machine button.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
but you're only the master until your file table just completely gets screwed.
Exactly. The other thing to keep in mind is that there are some BIOSes. There's actually a setting in BIOS that says power button instant off or delay 4 seconds. And if you have it set to instant off and Windows doesn't override it, that can be bad.
Mm. I've got mine to delay 4 seconds.
A lot of the work.
Pretty much everything
still
is set that way
reset
these days.
Buttons.
Now, Windows 7, you can press the shutdown button. It will try to cleanly shut everything down, and it is basically probably 99.9% okay to do that. XP
7 is cool
careful.
Too because it actually brings up a dialog that says how many programs need to close, and it has a little list box that tells you all the programs that still need to close. And you can
and
tab to the cancel
hey,
button if you decide
trouble.
You want to go back to Windows and mess with stuff before you shut it down. And assuming JAWS
that's
hasn't been
nice.
Turned off yet, that dialog box speaks.
It does.
In my experience, I only use the shutdown button because everything's not speaking.
The shutdown button is panic. I want my computer back and don't know what alien has taken it over.
I've done that many times.
Oh, me too.
Does anybody remember End at All for Windows 98?
I have a reset button.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Same thing.
No, the reset button is actually an instant hardware switch that will basically cut and re-put the power straight back to the guts of the system board. And if you want to do a number on your file system, that's the button to press. It's much safer to tap the power button and let the machine try and shut down rather than just belting the reset button. It's a bit like the difference between asking your other sibling if you could change the channel rather than just walking in with a rolled up newspaper, belting them, snatching the remote control and flicking the channel. It's not as safe.
You're gonna have to do that. It's a...
What, belt your sibling with a rolled up newspaper?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that sounds good.
Roommates, but yeah.
We do not condone belting anybody with rolled up anything, but the point is that that reset button is an instant reset. It basically just tears the machine down. Whatever it's doing, it doesn't get any chance to save data out of the caches or anything, and just goes bang and resets it, whereas at least if you tap the power button and wait for it to shut down, it actually has a chance of saving stuff out.
Needless to say, does it make a difference? Machines do not have reset buttons anymore.
Yeah.
They do. People just don't wire them up.
Some do. Some don't.
Yeah, there's also mine has a turbo button. Is there a reason, by the way, is there a difference between holding the power button down and having it shut off that way versus hitting the reset button, or unplugging it versus hitting the reset button?
Oh, no. It's, you're basically doing the same sort of thing.
If you hold the power button in for 4 seconds, it's got 4 seconds of terror time where it desperately tries to save everything that you're doing before the power is torn from its stressed-out interior and it thunks down into nothingness. Okay? If you actually just tap the power button and let it shut down nicely, it will actually have more time. And there are actually registry hacks and things that you can actually set that tell it how long it's going to give each process to end and when it's going to belt the processors over the head with a brick. So you can go, look, if you don't respond within 10 or 20 seconds, you're gone. There's actually registry settings you can set to make that happen.
Yeah, you can do stuff like that with 7.2, I think, and I don't need to do the registry anymore. So the thing, what I think would be great is if when you press the button, obviously it'll try as long as it can, but I think it would be great is if you're holding it down, the computer would act like it only has 4 seconds to live and just be like, crap, crap, crap.
That would be nice, but yeah.
Well, it pretty much does, doesn't it? Isn't that basically what you're saying?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
No, well, no, because if you hit the button, then it'll act like it has forever.
Has anybody ever had
sometimes
that problem?
Sometimes what I'll do, if I know that a computer's going to take ages, sometimes I'll just push the button and then hold Alt E down and just say, yes, end everything.
Oh, that's a good idea.
If the dialogues come up, just, yes.
That's dangerous.
That's
in fact, that's
I know
that's
it's dangerous,
no,
I know. But
yeah, that's fine. As long as you realize that that's just as bad as just, why don't you just rip the power cord out? It'll be quicker. That's what you're doing.
My strategy is pretty much to hit the button and then watch the activity light. And I hit the power button and the activity light just stays quiet and I can't do anything with the keyboard at that point. Yeah, I'm just like, screw you, guy.
Pretty much.
You know what? It's not fair. You're gifted with the ability of light perception and you can do that.
I know, it's terrible. Actually, well, in the old days, you could listen to the hard drive grind, but you can't do that anymore either.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, I touch the hard drive or listen.
Actually,
it doesn't work on my new machine, but if you're on a laptop, you can hear the background hiss of the, let's say through the headphones, and you can hear the click when it comes up, and you can hear the click when it goes down, if you're really quite perceptive, because
it doesn't
work on my new one, but on my old one, the sound was about the last thing to go, so it was really good, as in that, I'm not saying Jaws, I'm saying that actual background hiss.
That little click to turn it off, yep.
At that point, you might as well just listen to the computer itself.
What were you going
to
say, Aiden?
I've actually got a light probe. I don't know who sells them, probably various independent stores. It's a small thing, and it's a square box with a little tube on one end, and that tube has a light sensor, and it tells where lights are on, and it's designed in such a way that if you put it over a certain light, the sound will change when the light flashes.
Cool.
So I'm starting to slowly use it, get used to using it on different types of lights and things like connectivity lights for routers and stuff.
Cool.
Just another point that I showed a couple of people here yesterday, but I haven't shared with the rest of the class. Buy yourself a cheap AM/FM radio from whatever electronics store you have handy, $10 or $15, put a couple of batteries in it, and sit it near your computer and listen to the interference patterns. That will tell you when your computer is easy-wizzy, let's get busy.
Or an AM radio.
Well, I said
AM/FM. It is an AM radio. It has to be on the AM band.
No, it works on FM too.
You said AM/FM. It's a lot quieter on FM, though. You have to find a specific channel.
It's much louder on AM.
AM.
And it'll be able to you'll be able
technology
to...
up with an AM radio, and you'll get some fantastic sounds.
Huh. Also, fire off a camera Brown's... flash with an AM radio. Has anybody ever done that?
Oh no, I have not.
Okay, it has to be a real camera with a real flash, and you fire it off, and it goes.
Cool.
It's amazing.
But that AM radio can really save you. If your hard drive's too quiet to hear, or even like if you want to know if any electronic device is powering up or booting or being active, you can do this on Bluetooth keyboards to hear if they're in pairing mode because they make different sounds with that. You can do this with a GPS receiver. You can do it with a phone. It's really cool.
I did it with my iThing when I first got it to see if the power button really had turned it on. You know how there's the uncertainty time that you have to hold the power button down before it actually happens?
Yes.
Well, the radio can take that uncertainty away.
Yeah.
So what, you hold the power button with the thing next to the radio until it does something odd, Kerry, is basically what you're saying? Or?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool trick.
I need to catalog all the times I actually use my light perception, because I'm realizing how much I use it, and I didn't used to. I'm like, this is useless! So, huh.
Okay, right-click, or where were we? Okay, to customize settings in my computer... right-click My Computer and choose Processing. Choose Properties, I'm sorry. Settings can be customized, including computer name, hardware settings. That's a place you can actually get in to see your device manager. Virtual memory, automatic updates, remote access, and all of that good stuff. Now, in Windows Vista 7, my network is called Network. My computer is called Computer. My documents is called Documents. They just get rid of all the My.
They actually call it My Documents now if you go into the folder.
The thing is if you're going to go to the folder where My Documents is, it's whatever your name is or whatever you name, you know,
yep.
Like Curtis.
The other thing is I had to change that My thing because when you're working on things like terminal servers and stuff, it's not actually your computer at all. So they actually did have to take the My out for that reason.
If you do the properties on a computer in 7, it's basically the same as system information now.
Yep.
They've kind of combined those two things.
That's what it is with XP as well, actually. You can do the same thing. At Aldunter, I think you get system, don't you?
No, system... Oh, if you go to system. Yeah, I mean system information. Like in XP, you used to be able to go to like programs, accessories, system tools, system information, and it would come up with this whole different thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now I believe that's the same tool as properties for my computer.
Okay. We all know that you can access drives in my computer, right? We know how my computer works. Does anyone need me to go over that? Oh, well. We'll fix you two after lecture.
Did anybody know?
On my computer, you select the drive.
You press enter to select the drive. There's also a thing that I didn't realize this, but there's actually a nifty way of changing the default Explorer shortcut under Windows. You know how if you've got a floppy drive and you arrow down in the Explorer and it goes plunk, no disk in floppy drive? You can stop that from happening because there's actually a key shortcut that will stop Explorer from opening up the folder until you've actually gone across to the tree. You can Google that up if you want.
Does everybody know how to launch an application on your computer? Everybody knows what I'm talking about when I say,
yeah,
double-click it, press enter, you can run it from the command prompt, find it in the start menu. Yep, there you go. Okay, good.
You can execute programs from the search box also, just type it in, hit enter, and it just goes, opens it up for you.
Alright, control panel. If you have not been into your control panel, explore your control panel today and see what kind of cool things you can do in it. I don't know what else more I need to really say about that. And there's notes about it in the chapter. You can read those as well. If you need help, write to the discuss list or me or Sean, and we'll help you. The Computer Management Console allows you to manage many aspects of both your computer and a remote computer. It addresses three main areas of administration, system tools, storage, and services and applications. You need administrator privileges to access the Computer Management Console. To view this console, you're going to go Start Control Panel Administrative Tools Computer Management. You can also view it for a remote computer. You click connect to another computer in the tree, and you can browse for the computer or type in the computer you manually want to work on. Task Manager, Alt Control Delete, and then Windows T, or sorry, Alt T if you are in.
Hang on, Control Shift Escape.
Yeah, I was just going to say that Control Shift Escape is so much better.
What?
That is a shortcut to get there, but you can hit Alt Control Delete and hit Alt T as well.
And sometimes you don't need Alt T, like if you don't have the log on welcome screen, or if you turned
it to in Windows XP, in Windows 7 you always do.
Okay.
In Windows 7 it comes up with this whole.
Still work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
I don't even know that.
And actually, I remember I read an interesting email on the Control Shift Escape thing. Like, it apparently does different stuff in different versions of XP and different settings and computers and stuff.
It used to actually be a keystroke. Well, Control Escape used to be what pulled up the task manager in Windows 3.1, but they had to change it to Control Shift Escape because Control Escape pulls up the start menu if your keyboard is unlucky enough not to have a Windows key. Yes, I still have some at home that don't have Windows keys.
Do it? Okay. Control Shift Escape is one of these things I know about, but have not yet gotten into my motor memory for my computer, and really should work on that.
We use it in tech support all the time. After people push Control Alt Delete, and I wouldn't know what to do after that.
It's actually good because Control Alt Delete, especially on Windows 7 and all, can take quite a while to get into that dialog. So you can, and then you hit Alt T, and then you don't know if it's come up or not.
The other point is that one of the other things I'd point out to people is that Control Shift and Escape don't move around as much as the Delete keys and stuff tend to. Finding Delete on a new keyboard can be a battle. I mean, how many JAWS users get into the terror when they're going, where's the insert key?
Yeah.
I had a laptop that had Windows in the upper right corner or thereabouts, so if you're unfamiliar with a laptop, Control Escape is the best way to bring up the start menu if you think it's one of those ones where the Windows key might be second in from the top right corner.
Sometimes you don't even need Alt-T. Like, this doesn't happen on 7, but I remember in like older XP or XP Home, if you do Control Alt-Delete, it just brings up Task Manager right away.
You might be XP Home. It doesn't on Pro. I just tried it.
Yeah, it's XP
Home. Depends
if you
have to log in
that
log enabled.
You can set that.
All right, we need to get going.
The rest of this, a lot of this section you can read on your own. It's just basically about uninstalling and installing programs. You have labs on doing this. We talk about services and starting and stopping services. You use services.msc to do this and make sure you actually really want to stop a service from coming up automatically. You have a few different modes for services to be started. You have automatic, which will mean it will automatically start it up. Delayed automatic, this is new in, I believe, Vista and 7. That will give it you a few minutes before the system starts up. Windows Update uses this. Manual, which means you will start it up if it's needed or a program will call it. Or Disabled, which means nothing can start that service.
Sorry, services such as what?
There are various services.
Windows Update service.
Help and
JAWS
support.
Can be run as a service.
Yeah, JFW
spyware,
services.
Spyware, anti-spyware programs uses a service. JAWS runs as a service if you want it to.
W32
NVDA
time management.
Java runs as one too.
Yep.
Yeah. One of the things you've got to be
subservices.
You got to be careful, guys, because there is a whole lot of articles on the internet that basically say you can speed your computer up by insert a funny number of percent by disabling the following 16 services. What they don't tell you is that if you disable the fax printing service because you don't think you're ever going to use it, and somebody goes to use a fax, it could be hours of debugging time before they realize that the fax service has been stopped and won't automatically start. So careful what services you kill off.
Not only that, you have to be careful with a lot of programs that you install because a lot of them will have the box automatically checked to start up with Windows. So you have to make sure that it's unchecked or you have a whole bunch of programs starting and don't know why.
No, that's a different thing, though.
Yeah, it's the same, similar thing.
Services are usually lower level and more behind the scenes and you don't normally see
iTunes
stuff. It's
better to set things to manual.
Depends on the service.
It depends on the service.
Because some programs won't automatically...
You don't want to turn your sound service off. You don't want to turn that to manual.
You don't want to turn
human
interface
devices. Well, if it's manual, then JAWS could still call it, wouldn't it?
No.
It doesn't, though. It just assumes it's running all the time.
And some programs
maybe it could,
depend
it's
on
just
services.
They don't program it that way.
For example, iTunes Helper and stuff, to get all that nifty, sharey stuff, there's all sorts of nasty network services and stuff that go onto your computer to make all that magic happen, all the...
VMware as a service. ABBY has most, pretty much anything that runs, a lot of programs have licensed servers as well that are services like Kurzweil and FineReader and the like.
Yeah, so don't mess with them if you don't have to.
And free anything Freedom Scientific, obviously the Sentinel thing is a service.
They have about 50 services, I think.
I've got tons. Okay, upgrading an operating system. Sometimes you'll just want to upgrade an operating system. Make sure you have a backup and make sure to check the HCL to make sure that your hardware is compatible. Make sure your computer meets the system requirements for the hardware. Make sure your applications will work on the new operating system. All of that good stuff. Take a backup. It says that upgrading an operating system can take a much shorter time. I have found this is not usually the case, but okay. If you're upgrading from XP to Vista...
It does if you don't have to install 300 applications like Office after the clean install. That's what they're saying. It's quicker to upgrade an operating system in place than it is to install a copy of Office, a copy of CCleaner, Winamp,
fair
iTunes.
Enough.
You know, not everybody has our file server.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. Something important that you need to know, when upgrading from Windows XP to Vista, you need to make sure that Service Pack 2 is installed, or else you're not going to be able to upgrade.
2 or better.
2 or better. The Vista and Windows 7 installations have a new feature. They will prompt you if you're online to download any important updates before you upgrade your computer. You can also just say no if you're not online, and that's okay too.
You should do it though. I think SP2 and SP3 installs will do this as well, actually. Can't remember at what point they started doing it, but I know some XP installs will let you do it.
One of the problems is if you say no to the can I download stuff now before I do the upgrade, it's possible that you will come up without devices that you might want, like networking cards or wireless networks that you don't happen to have drivers for. So YMMV, be careful. I usually say yes.
When a new installation of Windows is needed, you can use the Windows User State Migration Tool, USMT, to migrate all of the current user files and settings to the newer operating system. This allows you to restore configurations and customizations from the current computer to the newly installed Windows operating system. You know what? I found that this is a lot of times more trouble than it's worth.
It works, though, and that transfer files and settings wizard is an absolute saviour because it finds all of the documents, all of the favourites, and all of the settings and does them in one bog lot. You don't have to do them all by hand. It's very cool.
And there's a diagram you guys should look at and know very well about which operating systems can be upgraded to other operating systems. So have a look at that. Have a go and see what you think of that. And that's just something very important for your daily life as a technician. The rest of this, you've got two sections that you have a couple of other sections that you guys can read that are pretty simplistic. Your preventative maintenance and troubleshooting, which are at the end of about every chapter for the rest of your ITE1 life. And basically, if we have time to go through these, we will. If we don't, these you'll be responsible for on your own to read. If you have questions about them, bring them to class, and we will have a quick quiz next week on this chapter, and we'll go on to laptops. So there is that massive chapter done. Did everybody enjoy themselves? Are you glad to be done?
That was good. If anything, I wish we had an extra hour.
Yeah. He wants more time. But we've spent... Luke, yeah, I would like more time on this, too. It's another chapter where you could spend 6 weeks on it, if you had 6 weeks to spend.
Okay, I'm hitting stop.